You're listening to This Week in Palestine, a program that brings you in-depth reporting, thoughtful commentary, and diverse perspectives on the ongoing struggle for Palestinian liberation. Our content is rooted in the lived experiences and narratives of the Palestinian people, while also engaging voices from around the world to explore the broader geopolitical context. We aim to challenge dominant narratives, amplify underrepresented truths, and provide a platform for analysis that too often goes unheard in mainstream media. Please note, the views and opinions expressed during the next hour are those of the hosts and guests, and do not necessarily reflect the views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. We're here to inform, provoke thought, and foster dialogue. Thank you for joining us. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be. I'm Bethany Marks, and I welcome you back to another episode of This Week in Palestine. As always, we turn our gaze toward Palestine. But today, we take a different path, one that traces the roots of Palestinian suffering, not just within the borders of the region, but to the halls of power in Washington and across the Western world. To understand the crisis in Gaza, the occupation in the West Bank, and the daily dehumanization of an entire people, we must examine the role that American and Western policy has played in shaping this ongoing tragedy. The world may know whose land this is, but it's the dominance of global power structures that keeps justice at bay. The headlines shift. Politicians offer statements. The media redirects its attention. But on the ground in Palestine, the reality remains unchanged: dispossession, resistance, and survival. It is Sunday, June 29th, 2025, and we continue to ask the same burning question. What will it take to turn global outrage into meaningful action? Stay with us as we dive deeper into the mechanisms of power and the truth they work so hard to suppress. Is the Iranian-Israeli war truly over? Or perhaps the more pressing question is, has the Iranian-American war just begun? What we're witnessing isn't just a regional flare-up, it's a geopolitical earthquake. The headlines may focus on missiles and military strikes, but beneath the surface lies a deeper struggle. Is this war really about Israel's security? Or is it about preserving American dominance in the Middle East? And where, in all of this, do Palestine and the Palestinian people fit? Are they simply collateral in a larger imperial chess game? Or is their liberation central to the very conflict unfolding before us? To help us unpack these layered questions, we turn to journalist and geopolitical analyst Ben Norton, whose recent reporting dives into the real motivations behind the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. According to Norton, this war is not just about nuclear facilities or regional threats. It's about maintaining U.S. hegemony in West Asia, crushing the anti-colonial axis of resistance, and ensuring the continued colonization of Palestine. In his analysis, Norton outlines several key objectives driving this conflict: preserving the petrodollar system, which underpins U.S. global economic power; preventing de-dollarization and the rise of alternative financial systems led by BRICS nations; destabilizing Iran's revolutionary government, which has long resisted Western influence; breaking the Iran-Russia-China alliance, a growing bloc that challenges U.S. unipolarity; and perhaps most critically, ensuring that Palestine remains fragmented and occupied as part of a broader strategy to suppress resistance movements across the region. This isn't just a war of bombs and borders. It's a war of narratives, alliances, and global influence. And as Norton makes clear, the Palestinian struggle is not a side note. It's a central thread in the fabric of this conflict. So as we ask whether the war is over, we must also ask, what kind of peace are we being offered? One built on domination and silence, or one rooted in justice and self-determination? Let's listen now to Ben Norton's full analysis and begin to understand the war behind the war. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio.
Israel is at war with Iran. Israel started this war by launching a surprise attack on Iran on the 13th of June. And in the following days, Iran hit back, Israel attacked Iran again, and it escalated into a larger conflict. Now, the U.S. government is deeply involved in this war on Iran. U.S. President Donald Trump knew about all of the operations because the U.S. was helping Israel to plan and to carry out this attack. Israeli officials were given a very clear green light from the U.S. government, and Donald Trump personally gave his approval to Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. government also provided Israel with very important intelligence that was used to target Iranian officials. And just 3 days before Israel started this war, the U.S. delivered 300 Hellfire missiles to Israel, knowing that Israel would use these U.S. missiles in order to attack Iran. And after Israel started the war, the U.S. military got directly involved. This was admitted by the Wall Street Journal. The newspaper reported, quote, "The U.S. military is operating in the air, on land, and at sea to shoot down Iranian missiles fired at Israel," end quote. It added that before Iran's retaliatory strikes even began, U.S. fighter jets, Navy destroyers, and ground-based air defense systems were already positioned in place to help counter the attacks on Israel. This is even more evidence that the U.S. government planned this attack on Iran with Israel because the U.S. military was already in place. 90% of the victims of these U.S.-backed Israeli attacks on Iran have been civilians, 90% civilians. Donald Trump has repeatedly threatened Iran, and he ordered a complete evacuation of the Iranian capital, Tehran. There were roughly 10 million people living in Tehran, and yet Trump ordered all of them to leave. And why is that? It's because the U.S. and Israel planned to bomb Tehran into rubble. This was admitted by Israel's Channel 14. The media outlet admitted that Israel's goal is to destabilize and eventually overthrow the Iranian government. So this is not about Iran's nuclear program. This is about regime change. The U.S.-Israeli strategy is to cause mass chaos and scare the civilian population and force millions of people to be displaced, which will destabilize the government, and then the U.S. and Israel plan to bomb Tehran into smithereens. Israel's defense minister said, quote, "Tehran will be treated like Beirut," end quote, referring to the 2006 Israeli war on Lebanon, in which Israel devastated the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and bombed civilian infrastructure, causing mass chaos. Israeli military officials have admitted that they could not wage war without support from the U.S. government, and that includes Israel's war on Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, and now Iran. The U.S. is providing Israel with the missiles and the planes and the intelligence that it's using to attack Iran. This war would be impossible without U.S. support. And this is bipartisan U.S. policy. The Joe Biden administration gave Israel more than $18 billion of weapons and ammunition, and the Trump administration is also sending billions of dollars of military aid to Israel. So the very important point that I wanted to establish at the beginning here is that this is a joint U.S.-Israeli war. This is not a war that Israel launched without the support of the U.S. It's not Israel that's dragging the U.S. into war. The U.S. government is deeply involved, gave the green light to Israel, and is overseeing this war against Iran. If you want more information about that, in the description below, I will link to the other video and article that I did explaining that point. But today I want to answer another question, which is why the U.S. and Israel are waging war on Iran. What is the goal of this joint U.S.-Israeli war? Well, the reality is there's not just one goal, but rather multiple goals. I wrote out a list of the main things that the U.S. empire is trying to accomplish with this war on Iran. The first and most obvious is to maintain U.S. hegemony in West Asia, also known as the Middle East. The second is to destroy the anti-colonial axis of resistance. I'll talk about that later. This is the alliance of revolutionary groups in the region that are allied with Iran and have been fighting the U.S. and Israel. And by destroying the axis of resistance, this would make it possible for the U.S. and Israel to carry out the total colonization of Palestine, which is obviously one of their main goals. I mean, this strategy is not new at all, but Donald Trump said the quiet part loud, and he admitted that the U.S. wants to colonize Gaza and turn it into an outpost for the U.S., especially one where he could build luxury real estate and profit.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it. You know, Gaza's interesting. It's a phenomenal location. On the sea, best weather. You know, everything's good. It's like some beautiful things could be done with it.
But the U.S. empire also has several other goals in the joint U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Another is obviously to prevent Iran from developing nuclear capabilities. Iran does not have nuclear weapons, although Israel does. And moreover, the U.S. government has tried for decades to overthrow or at least weaken the independent revolutionary government in Iran that came to power in 1979 through a revolution. This has been a long-standing goal. Another major goal of this war is to scare other countries in the region that may want to move away from the United States, and in particular, the dollar. And this especially is targeted at the Gulf monarchies like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, because these countries export a lot of oil and gas, which means they make a lot of foreign currency, in particular U.S. dollars, because the U.S. imposed a petrodollar system on the region in the 1970s, forcing these countries to sell their oil and gas in dollars, which maintains global demand for the U.S. dollar. However, in recent years, the Persian Gulf countries have been moving closer and closer to China, which is their largest trading partner, and even Saudi Arabia is now talking about selling its oil in China's currency, the renminbi or yuan, which would be a major blow to the global dominance of the U.S. dollar. Again, I'm going to go into greater detail about this issue later. This is just a brief summary. So again, one of the goals of this U.S.-sponsored war on Iran is to preserve the petrodollar system and ensure continued global demand for the U.S. dollar. Related to that is the U.S. goal of destabilizing BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. BRICS is the Global South-led organization that originally consisted of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, but it has expanded greatly, and in 2024, Iran became a full member of BRICS. Iran also officially became a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in 2023. Again, I'll talk more about that later. But the point is that this U.S.-sponsored war against Iran aims at dividing the Global South and disrupting the multipolar project in which Global South-led organizations like BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization play a key role. And the final goal related to that is that the U.S. wants to break up the partnership between Iran, Russia, and China, with the ultimate goal of isolating Beijing. Because the United States is waging a new Cold War on China, this is Cold War II. This is admitted openly now in Washington. It's no longer even controversial saying that. So the U.S. is trying to isolate China by dividing it from some of its most important allies, and some of the most powerful partners of China include Russia and Iran. This is why Donald Trump himself admitted that he wants to divide Russia and China, because this is the age-old strategy of divide and conquer.
You never want Russia and China uniting. We united them. It's a shame. The stupidity of what they've done. Well, I'm going to have to ununite them, and I can think I can do that too. I have to ununite them.
If the U.S. can destabilize the independent revolutionary government in Iran, potentially even overthrowing it, and especially if the U.S. can divide Russia and China, this is part of Washington's new Cold War strategy to isolate Beijing. So you can see that this U.S.-backed war against Iran is about much more than just Israel-Palestine, and it's also about more than just West Asia, just the Middle East. This is a conflict with major geopolitical and economic implications spanning the entire world. And in the rest of the analysis today, I'm going to go through point by point and explain the goals and the strategy of the U.S. empire in this joint U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Now, I want to start by highlighting an excellent point that was made by Brian Berletic, who is the host of the independent news outlet The New Atlas, and he does great research. And Brian Berletic pointed out, I think correctly, that the U.S. is using Israel as it uses Ukraine, Taiwan, and the Philippines to advance its goal of confronting multipolarism or multipolarity, destroying Iran, which is a major nation promoting this global South-led multipolar project to challenge the unipolar order in the world that was dominated by the U.S. empire in the 1990s and early 2000s. It was the only superpower in the world, and the U.S. could impose its hegemony on most other countries. Brian Berletic points out, correctly, that the U.S. is using Israel as a proxy specifically to redirect blame and literal incoming missiles away from the U.S. and toward its proxy, Israel. And this isn't in any way to excuse Israel for the horrific crimes it's been carrying out in Gaza, in Syria, in Lebanon, and now in Iran. Of course, Israel is directly responsible for these war crimes and crimes against humanity. But it's important to point out why Israel is carrying out all of these horrific crimes, and it's on behalf of the U.S. empire. This was spelled out very clearly in a plan that was published by several U.S. government officials for the Washington, D.C.-based think tank, the Brookings Institution, which is very closely linked to the U.S. government and basically acts as a kind of outsourced arm of the U.S. government. In 2009, these U.S. government officials, these U.S. imperial planners, published a strategy paper titled Which Path to Persia? Options for a New American Strategy Toward Iran. And chapter 5 is titled Leave It to Bibi, that is Benjamin Netanyahu. So leave it to Netanyahu, allowing or encouraging an Israeli military strike on Iran. In this paper, these U.S. government officials at a U.S. government-backed think tank wrote that the U.S. should encourage Israel to attack Iran. And this is what they said, quote, "The United States would encourage and perhaps even assist the Israelis in conducting the strikes themselves, in the expectation that both international criticism and Iranian retaliation would be deflected away from the United States and on to Israel," end quote. This is exactly what the U.S. empire is doing today. I mean, they spelled it out so clearly. It's so obvious. Trump personally gave Israel the green light. He knew about the operation. He helped to plan it. Trump delivered Israel hundreds of missiles 3 days before Israel started the war. And the U.S. has been giving Israel billions and billions of dollars of weapons and military assistance for decades, but especially since 2023. The Biden administration and the Trump administration together have given well over $20 billion of weapons and ammunition, missiles, and other military equipment to carry out these proxy wars on behalf of the U.S. empire. And this is why the former U.S. Secretary of State Alexander Haig famously said, quote, "Israel is the largest American aircraft carrier in the world that cannot be sunk. It is located in a critical region for American national security," end quote. So in other words, Israel is an unsinkable aircraft carrier for the U.S. empire. This was even admitted by Israel's longest ever serving prime minister, basically the king of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu famously said that Israel is a, quote, "mighty aircraft carrier," end quote, of the United States. And by the way, Netanyahu is an American. He was raised and educated in the U.S. He went to high school and college and got his first job in the U.S. He had U.S. citizenship twice, and he only gave up his U.S. citizenship in order to be Israel's prime minister. But he is an American, and what he's doing is serving the interests of the U.S. empire. So this brings me to the first goal of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, which is to maintain U.S. hegemony in West Asia, also known as the Middle East. This was clearly spelled out by the Pentagon, the U.S. Department of Defense, back in 1992 in the infamous Wolfowitz Doctrine. This was a plan that was written by the Undersecretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, a notorious warmonger. And in the Wolfowitz Doctrine, he stated very clearly that the goal of the U.S. Empire was to prevent the rise of any other superpower that could challenge the dominance of the United States in the world. At this time in the 1990s, the Soviet Union had just been overthrown a year before, in 1991. The U.S. was the only major power in the world. It was a unipolar world dominated by the U.S. Empire. And they wrote very clearly in this Pentagon document that the quote, goal is to preclude any hostile power from dominating a region critical to our interests, end quote. And they named several regions. Among them were the Middle East / Persian Gulf and also East Asia. And those are the main two areas today that the U.S. military is targeting, especially under Trump. In East Asia, the U.S. is militarizing the region to try to encircle China as part of the new Cold War. And now, of course, the U.S. is using Israel to wage war all across the Middle East, West Asia, to try to recreate the region, overthrowing all of the independent governments and propping up pro-U.S. regimes. And as they stated very clearly in the Wolfowitz Doctrine, the goal is also to maintain U.S., quote, control of the resources of such a critical region, end quote. So if you think about the geography of this region, if you look at a map, it becomes pretty clear why the U.S. Empire has been so dedicated to propping up this colonial regime in Israel and why this has been bipartisan, because it is perfectly located geostrategically, geographically, as a launch pad for the U.S. to wage war on all of the other countries in the region to maintain control over West Asia, over the Middle East. I mean, Israel-Palestine is this crucial point that links West Asia to the Mediterranean, going into Europe. It also links West Asia to Northern Africa, to Egypt. So the U.S. Empire has used this unsinkable aircraft carrier in Israel to attack Iran, to attack Iraq. Let's not forget the U.S. invaded Iraq 2 times. To attack Syria after over a decade of war on Syria that started in 2011 and ultimately succeeded in the overthrow of the Syrian government in late 2024. The U.S. has also been attacking Yemen. The Donald Trump administration waged war on Yemen, continuing the war that was also waged by Obama and Biden. So the U.S. is constantly using Israel to destabilize all of the independent governments in the region and maintain hegemony over West Asia. Now, obviously, it goes without saying that West Asia has the largest reserves of oil and natural gas on Earth. 9 of the world's top 20 largest oil producers are located in this region. However, I should point out, the United States is the world's number one producer of oil. Similarly, 7 of the top 20 largest producers of natural gas are located in this region. Although, once again, the United States is the number one producer of natural gas on Earth as well. So it's not that the United States needs this oil and gas. The U.S. has tons of oil and gas. Of course, U.S. corporations, for-profit fossil fuel companies, would love to exploit the oil and gas of this region, which is largely controlled by state-owned companies. Saudi Arabia, for instance, has the massive state-owned oil company Saudi Aramco, and the other Persian Gulf countries also have state-owned oil and gas companies. Of course, the U.S. would love to privatize all of this and sell it off to U.S. corporations, but it's not like the U.S. needs access to more oil and gas. What the U.S. is more concerned about is maintaining control over the global price of oil and natural gas. This is why the U.S. government for many years was waging a kind of political war against OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. This organization was famously used in 1973 to declare an oil embargo of the U.S. and other Western countries as part of a protest against Israel's war. So again, we see historical parallels of how Israel is acting as a vicious attack dog for the U.S. empire in this very strategic region. And today, the U.S. has largely succeeded in weakening OPEC because the U.S. has become the number one producer of oil. But the point is that the U.S. is very concerned about the possibility of oil production and prices of oil in the global market being used as a geopolitical weapon, given that the global South and also Russia and China are leading producers of oil and natural gas in the world. So if they were to unite and use a cartel like OPEC to control the price of oil or gas, it could cause significant economic damage and would lead to very high rates of inflation. Because when the price of energy goes up, it is an input in basically all other parts of the economy. So when the price of oil and gas goes up, the price of everything else goes up. And this obviously has led to a lot of political instability in the US. So the US is very concerned about the stability of the price of oil and natural gas in global markets. But what the US is also very concerned about vis-a-vis oil is the petrodollar system. I'm going to talk about this more in detail a bit later because I'm going to go point by point through the different goals of the US in this war. But this is a very important point that's related to oil and gas production in the region. But let's go back to this list of goals here. And I know I'm spending a lot of time on point one, but this is the most important point of all: the US strategy to maintain US hegemony in West Asia. It also makes perfect sense, at least from the perspective of imperial strategists, if you look at a map of the world and the role of this region in geostrategic choke points in the trade of oil and other goods. Three of the most important choke points on Earth are located in this region, including the Strait of Hormuz, the Bab al-Mandab, and the Suez Canal. The US government's Energy Information Administration, the EIA, has written clearly that, quote, "the Strait of Hormuz is the world's most important oil choke point," end quote. In fact, 21% of all of the barrels of oil used on Earth every single day pass through the Strait of Hormuz as of 2022. That is 1/5 of the entire supply of oil on Earth. And yet the Strait of Hormuz is tiny. If Iran wanted to, this would be a kind of nuclear scenario, politically speaking, but Iran could close the Strait of Hormuz, which would grind a lot of the global economy to a halt, or at the very least, it would cause very significant inflation because there would be a shortage of 21% of the world's oil supply basically overnight. But again, this is only one of the three critical choke points located in this region. Another geopolitical choke point is the Bab al-Mandab Strait, which connects the Arabian Sea into the Gulf of Aden, into the Red Sea, and then into the Mediterranean. This passes by Yemen, and this has become a major geopolitical choke point in recent years because the Yemeni resistance group Ansar Allah, popularly known as the Houthis, restricted access to the Red Sea by Israeli ships and Western ships of countries that are allied with Israel in protest of their war on Gaza. So we've seen a clear example of how these choke points can be used as geopolitical leverage to push for particular political goals. And the Bab al-Mandab is not quite as strategic as the Strait of Hormuz, but it's still very important. The US EIA estimated that 9% of seaborne traded petroleum travels through the Bab al-Mandab. And what's also important is that this connects to another very important choke point, which is the Suez Canal, which is one of the most important trade choke points on Earth. And in order to go through the Suez Canal, you have to first go through the Bab al-Mandab. So from a very basic geopolitical or even geographical perspective, if you just look at a map of West Asia, it becomes very clear why the imperial strategists in Washington, who are trying to maximize the power of the US empire around the world, it's very obvious why they are so desperate to maintain control over this region, especially at a time like now when China has become the largest trading partner of the countries in the region and the US is less and less important economically. So this is why the US is doubling down on its support for Israel and using Israel as a vicious attack dog to destabilize and wage war on all of the independent countries in the region, to threaten them and scare them and say, If you move away from the U.S.-dominated imperial order, you will face serious consequences like the people of Palestine and now the people of Iran. So this brings us to the second major goal of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, which is to destroy the axis of resistance and carry out the total colonization of Palestine. So what is the axis of resistance? This is the term that is used to refer to the alliance of anti-colonialist groups, armed groups, across West Asia, the so-called Middle East. And Iran is the largest and most powerful. Of course, Iran is an actual government, not just a small armed group, but it is allied with the armed group Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has its origins in the 1980s, fighting against Israel's illegal military occupation of South Lebanon. And of course, in Palestine, you have armed groups that have been fighting against Israel's illegal occupation and blockade. And in Gaza, this most famously includes Hamas, which is the political party and the armed group that governs Gaza. But there are also other Palestinian factions like the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is a socialist group with an armed wing. That's the PFLP. And in Yemen, you have the so-called Houthis, which are officially known as Ansar Allah. And Ansar Allah governs northern Yemen, where the majority of the Yemeni population lives. And yes, they are allied with Iran, but they're not so-called Iranian proxies. They have their origins in the Yemeni indigenous struggle against the extremist Wahhabi form of Islam that was exported by Saudi Arabia to Yemen and other countries. And also, Ansar Allah has its origins in groups that supported Palestine and also opposed the illegal U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. And over a decade, Ansar Allah grew in influence and became more and more popular, also especially fighting corruption in Yemen. And in 2014, on the 21st of September, they carried out a revolution, and they now govern the northern part of Yemen. And the U.S. and its allies, including Saudi Arabia and Israel and the UAE, have been fighting against the so-called Houthis, against Ansar Allah, for a decade now, starting in 2015, and have been unable to defeat them. But they're another very important part of the resistance axis. And then finally, in Iraq, you have the Islamic Resistance of Iraq and other armed groups, many of which were formed because they were fighting extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And by the way, the main victims of these extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS were Shia Muslims, because you know, obviously the vast majority of Sunnis in the world are not extremists, but these very extremist, violent fascist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, they distort Sunni Islam. They preach a very extreme form of Sunni Islam, and they see Shia Muslims as their main enemy. And they largely have killed a lot of Shia Muslims in countries like Iraq, where the Shia are the majority, and also in Syria, where the Shia are a minority, and also in Yemen, where the main base of Ansar Allah are Shia Muslims, the Zaydis, which is a sect that is related to Shia Islam, although their actual Islamic jurisprudence is more similar to mainstream Sunnis. But the point is that many of these groups have their origins in Shia Islam. And of course, Iran is the largest Shia majority country. The vast majority of Muslims in Iran are Shia. But this brings me to the final country that was previously part of the axis of resistance, which was Syria, when it was governed by the longtime leader Bashar al-Assad and his father, Hafez al-Assad. They were Arab nationalists. Syria was one of the countries in the region that always supported the Palestinian struggle and refused to normalize relations with Israeli colonialism. However, starting in 2011, the U.S. started a war in Syria, trying to overthrow the Syrian government. The CIA spent billions of dollars arming and training so-called rebels, many of whom later joined Al-Qaeda and ISIS, many of whom were extremists, Islamists, and they eventually succeeded with the support of Israel and the Gulf monarchies in Turkey, which is a member of NATO. Altogether, these countries supported the so-called rebels in Syria, and they succeeded in 2024 in overthrowing the Syrian government. And now Syria is governed by the former leader of Al-Qaeda. I'm not exaggerating in any way. the unelected so-called president of Syria since the previous government was overthrown is the former leader of Syria's al-Qaeda affiliate, the world's largest al-Qaeda affiliate, which was called Jabhat al-Nusra, which later rebranded with U.S. support as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, HTS. And the former leader of Syrian al-Qaeda, he previously used the name Abu Muhammad al-Julani, and now he uses the name, his birth name, Ahmad al-Shara, and he declared himself the so-called president of Syria. He was not elected. So, I mean, people love to criticize the former Baathist government of the Assad family in Syria. They love to criticize it for being authoritarian, but Syria today is just as authoritarian, if not even more authoritarian. I mean, it's ruled by the former leader of al-Qaeda, and the U.S. government has been working very closely to normalize relations and has been supporting the new al-Qaeda-led Syrian government because Syria is now working with the U.S. against Iran in an alliance with Israel. So now the rebranded al-Qaeda leader, who is the unelected president of Syria, Ashara, he said openly that he wants to normalize relations with Israel, which the previous Assad government had always refused to do. So he's obediently following U.S. orders. And I have to stress that this U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran was only made possible because of the overthrow of the Syrian government. And now Israel has colonized more and more Syrian land. They've destroyed Syria's military so it can't defend itself. And Israel used Syrian territory in order to launch these attacks on Iran. And keep in mind that the major British newspaper, The Telegraph, published a report with interviews with Syrian rebels who admitted that the U.S. military backed their operation to overthrow the Assad government in Syria. So again, this makes it very clear why the U.S. and Israel are waging war on Iran, because they already succeeded in overthrowing Syria and removing Syria from the resistance axis. And Israel has also been waging war in South Lebanon against Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance group that has its origins in the 1980s in the fight against Israel's illegal occupation of South Lebanon. So Israel weakened Hezbollah and killed its leadership. Israel has been taking control over Gaza, colonizing the West Bank, which according to international law is occupied Palestinian territory. The U.S. under Trump and also under Obama and Biden were waging war on Ansar Allah in Yemen, weakening them. And of course, the U.S. government invaded Iraq two times in the Gulf War and then again in 2003 in the Iraq War. And now the final target is Iran, which the U.S. and Israel are now attacking. This was famously admitted by Wesley Clark, the former U.S. general and commander of NATO. Back in 2007, in an interview, he admitted that the U.S. military had made plans to overthrow the governments of seven countries in 5 years. What were those seven countries? Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. Iran was the final country on the list. And of those seven, the U.S. succeeded in toppling or destabilizing the governments in six of those countries: Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, and Sudan. Iran is the final country remaining, and now the U.S. and Israel are openly, directly attacking Iran. This is what they've been planning for decades.
He said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
So now this brings me to another major goal of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, which is to overturn the Iranian Revolution, going back to 1979. This is the uprising that founded the Islamic Republic of Iran that ever since has been a target of the U.S. Now, it's very important to understand the role that Iran played before the 1979 revolution. In the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, Iran was ruled by a king, a monarch known as the Shah. He was installed in power in 1953 by the Western colonial nations after the CIA and British intelligence, MI6, organized a coup to overthrow Iran's democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, who was a left-leaning nationalist who had nationalized the oil of Iran, kicking out the Western oil corporations. And the U.S. was also very concerned that he would lean toward the Soviet Union in the original Cold War, the first Cold War that the U.S. was waging at the time. So the U.S. put in power the Shah, the king of Iran, and he was a loyal U.S. ally throughout this period. And at that time, Iran was a key part of what was known as the Twin Pillars policy. The U.S. empire tried to maintain control over West Asia. Saudi Arabia, another loyal U.S. ally, was the Western Pillar, and Iran was the Eastern Pillar in this Twin Pillars policy. However, that changed in 1979 with the Iranian Revolution, and the newly founded Islamic Republic was very influenced by Global South anti-colonial struggles, the national liberation struggles of what at that time was called the Third World. Now, it's important to understand that in the region in the 1960s and 70s, there were many different revolutionary movements. There were many different Marxist and socialist groups. There were communists. There were left-wing Arab nationalists who were also socialists, but who were against the communists. There was a lot of infighting and many different factions. But the point is that during the Cold War, the first Cold War, the U.S. was waging a brutal war against the socialist and communist groups in the region, and the U.S. used Israel and Saudi Arabia and its other allies to violently repress these revolutionary groups. And then when the U.S. defeated many of the communist groups, the U.S. started targeting the secular Arab nationalist groups. And the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia waged a war against Arab nationalist leaders. The most famous Arab nationalist leader was Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt. He led a revolution in 1952 against a Western-sponsored monarchy, and he created a new Arab nationalist republic. And Nasser inspired a movement of Arab nationalism all across the region. So then later you had the rise to power of Arab nationalists in Iraq and then in Syria. You had the formation of the Ba'ath Party, which was a party that combined socialism with Arab nationalism. And then you had a split in the Ba'ath Party between Syria and Iraq. But both Syria under Assad and Iraq under Saddam Hussein had Arab nationalist governments. And then in Libya, you had the revolutionary anti-colonialist leader Muammar Gaddafi, who was also an Arab nationalist and a socialist. And after the first Cold War ended, the Soviet Union was overthrown, and then the U.S. government waged a series of regime change wars, overthrowing Saddam Hussein in Iraq, who was from another faction of the Ba'ath Party, overthrowing Muammar Gaddafi in Libya in 2011, and then finally overthrowing Assad and the Ba'ath Party-led government in Syria in 2024. So the U.S. empire and its allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia, basically succeeded in defeating Arab nationalism. Today, there are no more Arab nationalist governments in West Asia. During the first Cold War, there were many Arab nationalist governments in Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. But all of those movements were destroyed. So the communists and the socialists were destroyed. Then the Arab nationalists were destroyed. And then what happened is you had the rise of Islamic nationalist groups, Islamist groups, but not the kinds of extremist Islamist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. You had a kind of revolutionary third world nationalist, global South nationalist movement in countries like Lebanon with Hezbollah, in Yemen with Ansar Allah, and of course in Iran with the Iranian Revolution. So Iran is one of the last bastions of anti-colonial resistance that the U.S. empire and its regional proxies have been trying to destroy to maintain U.S. hegemony over this region. So again, getting back to the list of goals in this U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, obviously the U.S. has tried for decades to overthrow or at least to weaken Iran's revolutionary government. But another goal of this war is to scare other countries in the region that may want to move away from the U.S. and the dollar, and especially the Persian Gulf monarchies. because Iran has been a major country pushing for de-dollarization, challenging the role of the US dollar as the global reserve currency. In fact, in recent years, Iran has been selling more and more oil and gas in other currencies. For instance, Iran has been exporting a lot of oil to China, which is the world's largest importer of oil, and China has been paying for that oil not with US dollars, but with China's own currency, the renminbi, also known as the yuan. This has allowed Iran and China to circumvent unilateral Western sanctions. The US has imposed very aggressive sanctions on Iran and also some on China. These sanctions violate international law because they don't have the endorsement of the UN Security Council, but it has devastated Iran's economy. So Iran is constantly trying to find ways around the US-dominated financial system, which has only further incentivized it to seek alternatives to the US dollar and to support a global movement that is growing of de-dollarization. And Iran is a significant player in global energy markets. Iran is tied with Iraq and China as the fifth largest producer of oil on Earth. And Iran is the world's number three producer of natural gas. And what the US is really concerned about is that other countries in the Persian Gulf may start doing exactly what Iran is doing and sell their oil and gas in other currencies, not in the US dollar. In fact, this is already happening. The United Arab Emirates has been selling liquefied natural gas, LNG, to China in yuan, not in dollars. And Saudi Arabia, which has historically been one of the most important oil producers on Earth, even Saudi Arabia is also in talks with China about selling its oil in China's currency, the yuan, which would be a massive blow to the US petrodollar system. What is the petrodollar system? Well, in order to understand this, we have to go back to August 1971, when US President Richard Nixon ended the convertibility of the dollar to gold. Because before that, going to the Bretton Woods Conference of 1944 at the end of World War II, the US dollar had been pegged to gold at a fixed exchange rate of $35 for 1 ounce of gold. Nixon ended that, and since 1971, the US dollar has been a freely floating fiat currency. This means that the value of the US dollar in relation to other currencies is constantly fluctuating up and down in the foreign exchange market. And in the 1970s, there was a lot of inflation in the United States, and the US was trying to find a way to stabilize the value of the dollar to bring down inflation. This is especially after the OPEC oil embargo in 1973, which caused oil prices to skyrocket. And in 1974, inflation in the US hit 11%, which was record-breaking at the time. In 1973, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, launched an oil embargo on the US and its Western allies because of their support for Israel, which was illegally occupying Palestinian, Egyptian, Syrian, and Jordanian territory. Let's not forget, this was a very revolutionary period in the 70s, and there were anti-colonial national liberation struggles happening around the world. So the Global South came together and used its power in the global oil market to use oil as a geopolitical weapon against the Western colonial powers. And this embargo immediately caused the price of oil to more than double. And then in the subsequent years, throughout all of the geopolitical turbulence, between 1973 and 1981, the price of oil increased by 5 times. This was a massive crisis. And this was a very significant reason for the sky-high rates of inflation in the US and in many other countries around the world in the 1970s. And by the way, a year and a half after the OPEC oil embargo, the leader of that embargo was assassinated. He was King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, and he had been very pro-Palestine and was very angry at Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory and also occupation of the territory of other neighboring Arab countries. So he is the one who, as the king of Saudi Arabia, which at the time was the de facto leader of OPEC, He oversaw the OPEC oil embargo, and a year and a half later, he was assassinated. But regardless, the point is that the OPEC oil embargo was a major wake-up call to the Western imperialist countries that colonized most of the world. It showed them that the global South, which produced the majority of the oil in the world, could unite, and through OPEC, they could use their influence in the global oil industry to do significant damage to the economies of the West. So, in 1974, a year after the OPEC oil embargo, the Richard Nixon administration made a plan to create the petrodollar system. And what happened? In 1974, Nixon sent the U.S. Treasury Secretary, William Simon, Bill Simon, to Saudi Arabia to make a deal. This is how Bloomberg described their goal. Quote, neutralize crude oil as an economic weapon and find a way to persuade a hostile kingdom, that is Saudi Arabia, to finance America's widening deficit with its newfound petrodollar wealth, end quote. And Nixon made it clear there was no coming back empty-handed. Now, this strategy was not only crafted by Nixon, but also by Nixon's all-powerful Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger. So Kissinger and Nixon sent the Treasury Secretary, Bill Simon, to Saudi Arabia. Who was William Simon? He was a Wall Street veteran who had served as the head of the Treasury's desk, bond trading, for the major Wall Street investment bank, Salomon Brothers. And in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, in 1974, this is the deal he made with the Saudis. I'm reading here from Bloomberg. Quote, Simon, better than anyone else, understood the appeal of U.S. government debt and how to sell the Saudis on the idea that America was the safest place to park their petrodollars, end quote. And then later on, quote, the basic framework was strikingly simple. The U.S. would buy oil from Saudi Arabia and provide the kingdom military aid and equipment. In return, the Saudis would plow billions of their petrodollar revenue back into treasuries and finance America's spending, end quote. This was famously spelled out by the economist Michael Hudson, a good friend of the show, back in his book, Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire. He explained how, with the war in Korea and then the U.S. war on Vietnam, the U.S. began running a larger and larger current account deficit, that is, a balance of payments deficit. The U.S. was importing more and more and exporting less and less. And Michael Hudson explained, with all of the data proving that the reason for that was because of the U.S. empire, the wars it was waging around the world, the balance of payments deficit was due to the U.S. military's global spending to maintain this empire with foreign military bases all around the world. So after Nixon ended the link of the U.S. dollar to gold, the way that he maintained global demand for the U.S. dollar was to force the Persian Gulf monarchies, especially Saudi Arabia, but then later the UAE and Qatar and others, to sell their oil and gas in U.S. dollars, which means that countries all around the world that need to import oil and gas have to get access to dollars. This maintains global demand for the U.S. dollar, and it has allowed the U.S. to run larger and larger current account deficits, trade deficits with the rest of the world over decades, and yet most countries would face a severe currency crisis if this happened. Their currency would fall significantly against the dollar and they would have hyperinflation. The reason it doesn't happen in the U.S. is because there's global demand for the U.S. dollar because countries need the dollar in order to pay for imports, not only of oil and gas, but many other commodities and other imports because the dollar is the global reserve currency. And also because other countries that have current account surpluses, trade surpluses with the rest of the world, they recycle the excess dollars they get from trade into U.S. government debt, U.S. Treasury securities, and other U.S. assets. So at the heart of the exorbitant privilege the U.S. has by printing the global reserve currency, the heart of that exorbitant privilege is the petrodollar system, and especially the Persian Gulf monarchies selling their oil and gas in dollars. So the fact that Iran and the UAE are already selling oil and gas to China in yuan is very concerning from the perspective of the US empire. And Washington is especially afraid of the possibility of Saudi Arabia doing the same. Now, Saudi Arabia still plays a very influential role in the global oil market as a swing producer, because Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil company, Saudi Aramco, is known to be used as a political tool when Riyadh wants to accomplish a certain goal. It can increase or reduce its oil production in order to influence the price of oil on the global market. And Saudi Arabia is still a major player in OPEC. So the US is very concerned about the possibility of Saudi Arabia moving away from the petrodollar and potentially toward a petro-yuan, or at the very least, selling its oil in different currencies with different trading partners. In fact, back in 2023, the Wall Street Journal published an article that outlined the demands that the Biden administration had imposed on Saudi Arabia as part of a plan to broker rapprochement with Israel. The US was pressuring Saudi Arabia to officially recognize Israel and to abandon the Palestinians. And according to this report, the US government had two main demands. One, Saudi Arabia had to cut its close ties with China. And two, Saudi Arabia had to give assurances that it will sell its oil in dollars, not the Chinese currency, the yuan. The Wall Street Journal wrote that, quote, "The Biden administration is seeking assurances from Saudi Arabia that it will distance itself economically and militarily from China. Officials said the U.S. could seek assurances from Saudi Arabia that it won't allow China to build military bases in the kingdom. Negotiators could also seek limitations on Saudi Arabia using technology developed by China's Huawei, and assurances that Riyadh will use U.S. dollars, not Chinese currency, to price oil sales," end quote. If you want more information about this, I have another video and an article specifically about this topic, which I will link to in the description below. But the point to take away is that the US is waging war on Iran as a threat to other countries in the region, telling them that if you act too independently like Iran, if you get too close to China and Russia, if you sell your oil and gas in other currencies and challenge the petrodollar, you will face consequences. The US is punishing Iran, waging war on Iran, and saying to Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Qatar, which have historically been US client regimes, like Iran was before the revolution in 1979 under the Shah, the US is telling them, do not try to copy what Iran is doing, or you will be the next Iran. So finally, this brings us to the last two goals of the US-Israeli war on Iran, which are deeply related, which is the attempt to destabilize BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, divide the global south, and disrupt the multipolar project, and also to break apart the partnership between Iran, Russia, and China with the goal of isolating Beijing in the new Cold War. Now, I already talked about how the Iranian Revolution was a kind of Islamic-oriented third world nationalist movement inspired by other global South struggles. And Iran has always been an ally of other anti-colonial movements. Iran is a close ally of Cuba and Venezuela and Nicaragua in Latin America, which have revolutionary anti-imperialist governments. Iran has good relations with many countries in Africa, and Iran has become very close to China and Russia. And in 2023, the BRICS summit was held in South Africa, and Iran was invited to become a full member. And of course, it accepted this invitation. And as of the 1st of January, 2024, Iran has been a full member of BRICS, along with the original five members, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, as well as Egypt, the UAE, Ethiopia, and Indonesia. And again, keep in mind, I was talking about the US attempt to impose hegemony on West Asia and North Africa. Well, now you have Iran, the UAE, and Egypt, which are all members of BRICS, and they're all in the region. And Saudi Arabia has been invited to join BRICS, although it has not officially given an answer. It's likely that Riyadh is using that as a bargaining chip with Washington and saying to Washington, well, if you put too much pressure on us, we'll join BRICS. So it's a card they can always play. But getting back to Iran. So Iran is now a full member of BRICS. And when Iran officially joined the Global South-led organization, the Iranian state media outlet Noor News published an article explaining its goals. It noted that Iran is seeking to, quote, lessen the influence of imposed sanctions over its economy, end quote. They also said that BRICS will help to challenge the, quote, current unilateral world order, end quote. So they're talking about the U.S.-dominated unipolar order, creating a more multipolar world. And then finally, this is a very important quote. Iran's state media outlet said that by joining BRICS, this will, quote, deepen the current existing relations between Beijing, Moscow, and Tehran as the three main architects of the new world order, end quote. So Iran is saying we have an alliance with China and Russia to challenge the U.S. empire. So it's obvious why the U.S. empire is so concerned about this and is trying to do everything it can to divide this alliance. I'm going to talk more about that in a moment here, but I also want to briefly talk about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or the SCO. Iran officially became a member of the SCO in 2023, and whereas BRICS is more of an economic and political organization, the SCO is more of a security organization, originally founded to fight against extremist groups in Eurasia. And members of the SCO include China, Russia, Iran, and also India and Pakistan and Kazakhstan and several other Central Asian republics. This is a very important organization for Eurasian integration. And the SCO has been speaking out against the U.S. war on Iran. In a statement on the 14th of June, the day after Israel started the war on Iran, the SCO stated that it, quote, strongly condemns the military strikes carried out by Israel, end quote. It condemned these as, quote, aggressive actions against civilian targets, including energy and transport infrastructure, which have resulted in civilian casualties, end quote. And it denounced these as, quote, a gross violation of international law and the United Nations Charter. They constitute an infringement on Iran's sovereignty, end quote. So from that statement, it looked like Eurasia was speaking with a very clear voice in denouncing this U.S.-Israeli war. However, for years now, the U.S. has been trying to divide the SCO, just like how the U.S. has been trying to divide BRICS. And after the SCO released this statement, the Ministry of External Affairs of India published a statement that distanced itself from the joint statement published by the SCO. Now, India currently has a very right-wing government led by the BJP, which is a Hindu nationalist party, and its Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And Modi and BJP are very pro-Israel. And in fact, the main opposition party in India, the left-leaning Congress Party, which originally, by the way, when India co-founded BRICS, it was under the left-leaning Congress Party, not under Modi and the BJP. Well, Congress publicly condemned Modi for allying with Israel so strongly as Israel is attacking Iran, which historically has had good relations with India. So India is sacrificing its relations with much of the global south in order to maintain good relations with Israel. So what this shows is that inside BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, there sometimes are some political divisions. They still do agree on many things, you could say maybe 80% of things, but on 20% of things, they have some severe disagreements. And this is why the core of this new multipolar world, the core of BRICS and the SCO, is the alliance between China, Russia, and Iran. And this is why the U.S. has been so desperate to break up this alliance. This is why NATO, which is led by the U.S., has been waging a proxy war against Russia in Ukraine for years. And this is why Donald Trump has made it very clear that he's trying to divide Russia and China. He wants the U.S. to improve relations with Russia in order to isolate China as part of the U.S. empire's divide and conquer strategy. Listen to Trump admit it openly here.
You never want Russia and China uniting. We united them. It's a shame. The stupidity of what they've done. Well, I'm going to have to ununite them, and I can think I can do that too. I have to ununite them.
And it's not just Iran that's the target. Iran is the medium-term goal. The long-term goal of the U.S. empire, the target, is China. The U.S. goal is to isolate China by overthrowing all of its major allies. And this was admitted, basically, by the CEO of Palantir, which is one of the most powerful contractors of the U.S. military and the CIA. The CEO of Palantir is Alex Karp, and he's a close ally of Donald Trump. And he admitted in an interview in 2024 that the U.S. is, quote, very likely, end quote, to fight a three-front war against China, Russia, and Iran. That was stated clearly by the CEO of Palantir, and he has a lot of insider knowledge because, again, Palantir is one of the most powerful U.S. government contractors. And by the way, the New York Times reported in May that Donald Trump is using Palantir to carry out mass surveillance of Americans, to compile data, to create big files on all Americans. So Palantir is directly complicit in mass surveillance, Big Brother style mass surveillance of all Americans on behalf of the US government. Palantir is basically an outsourced arm of the CIA and the Pentagon. In fact, Palantir originally received seed money from the CIA. It was partially a CIA creation. And one of the co-founders of Palantir is the far-right billionaire oligarch Peter Thiel, who also funded the political campaign of J.D. Vance, the U.S. vice president. J.D. Vance worked for Peter Thiel at his venture capital firm in Silicon Valley. So all of these U.S. corporations are invested in a war on Iran and China. China is their main goal, because China is the only country powerful enough to challenge the dominance of the U.S. empire, not only militarily, but more so economically and politically. And this was all spelled out clearly by the late U.S. imperial strategist Zbigniew Brzezinski, who formerly served as the U.S. National Security Advisor under U.S. President Jimmy Carter. In 1997, Brzezinski published a very influential book titled The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives. This was published a few years after the overthrow of the Soviet Union. And in this book, Brzezinski discussed ways in which the U.S. empire could maintain its unipolar dominance of the entire planet. He was very concerned about the possibility of alliances of countries that could challenge the global dictatorship of the U.S. empire, which is what it is. I mean, in the 1990s, the U.S. empire controlled basically everything in the world, and the U.S. empire imposed its policies on everyone at the barrel of a gun. It was a global U.S.-dominated dictatorship. And in this book, Brzezinski warned that, quote, the most dangerous scenario would be a grand coalition of China, Russia, and perhaps Iran, an anti-hegemonic coalition united not by ideology, but by complementary grievances, end quote. And that essentially is what we see today, is a kind of loose coalition between China, Russia, and Iran. This is why the CEO of the CIA-backed Trump-linked company Palantir is saying very clearly that the U.S. empire is preparing for a war against Russia, China, and Iran. The U.S. has already been waging a proxy war against Russia for a few years in Ukraine. Now the U.S. and Israel are waging war against Iran. The U.S. empire is using Israel as its vicious attack dog to wage war on Iran. And China is the main target. So the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran is not just about West Asia, about the Middle East. It's not just about Palestine. This is about the strategy of U.S. empire to try to maintain global domination and to divide and conquer. It's an age-old strategy, divide and conquer. This is a truly global conflict, and it is a perfect symbol of what we see today in the 21st century with the emerging multipolar world order. The US empire is doing everything it can to try to strangle the multipolar baby in its crib, to prevent the world from becoming more multipolar, to prevent the global South from truly decolonizing, not only politically like it did in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, but also economically by challenging neocolonialism. The US empire is desperate to try to save the decline of its hegemony and go back to the unipolar world that we had in the 1990s and early 2000s, when there were no other superpowers that could challenge the global dictatorship of the US empire, which is what it was. It was a global political and economic dictatorship controlled by the US. And any country that resisted the US, like Cuba and Venezuela and Iran, was punished with sanctions, with blockades, with regime change attempts, with color revolution attempts, and with war. That's why we see this war today, that the US is using Israel to wage against Iran. That's why the US is waging a proxy war against Russia in Ukraine. And that's why the US is preparing for war on China, which is the ultimate goal of the new Cold War being waged by the US, because China is the only country powerful enough to challenge the global dictatorship of the US empire. So now, with all of that said, I'm going to conclude. I know this was a very long analysis today, but I wanted to spend time thoroughly explaining why the US and Israel are waging war against Iran, providing all of this background information that is almost never mentioned in the Western corporate media, or if it is mentioned, it's all isolated. And it's very important to bring these facts all together to have a comprehensive understanding of this crisis. I hope you learned something from this analysis today. I hope you enjoyed it. I am Ben Norton. I am the editor-in-chief of Geopolitical Economy Report. I want to thank everyone for joining me today. Please like and subscribe. Please share this. I will see you all next time.
Before we close today's episode, we want to share this important call to action. Every Tuesday from 12 to 1, PM community members come together for the standout to stop the killing outside the Zionist consulate at 20 Park Plaza, Boston. Your presence sends a message. Stand in solidarity. Lift your voice. Demand justice. That wraps up today's episode. Stay informed, stay engaged, and never stop asking questions. Until next time, this is your host, Bethany Marks, and you've been listening to This Week in Palestine. If you have any questions or would like to support our work, feel free to reach out at twippodcasts@gmail.com. A heartfelt thank you to our incredible team working behind the scenes to make this show possible. Special appreciation goes to Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Mosa, Dr. Rana Awad, Juliette Salama Olivier, Professor Anne Lucas, Mohammed Algol, and Leash. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, broadcasting from WUZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we deeply appreciate you spending your time with us today as we continue to fight for Palestinian liberation. See you next week.